From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, images of fires ravaging Southern California filled the news. The devastation was news, impossible to look away from. But according to Mike Davis, historian at the University of California, Irvine, it wasn't new. What was new was the tone of disaster coverage post-Katrina.
For the last couple of days, at least the local TV and newspaper coverage in San Diego has been one long celebration. And pointedly, it said over and over again, one phrase used was, we've had a civilized evacuation. This is the opposite of Katrina. Making the point, here we are in Qualcomm Stadium. You can get a back rub, a yoga lesson, or a gourmet sandwich. The governor said, everybody's happy. What you're going to see, I believe, in San Diego County, at least, is a rather extraordinary outpouring of federal relief. And I'm sure people in New Orleans and other areas affected by Katrina, you know, are really wounded by the contrast, not only between the response, but between the characterization, the images that are being presented here, that we're dealing with two Americas, two different kinds of humanities.
Now, you've also argued that Los Angeles is prone to a whole slew of cyclical disasters. And so it's not a question of if, but when they occur.
Well, we live in a classical Mediterranean landscape. Earthquakes and fires and floods are just the normal metabolism of the landscape, but we deliberately almost keep putting ourselves in harm's way. What could be more stupid than to keep rebuilding the same mansions in Malibu at the mouth of a canyon out of which blowtorch-like Santa Ana winds carry fire punctually every 10 or 20 years?
So, Mike, if these problems are built in, how are they covered in the local media? National reporters might not get L.A., but you looked at the archives of the Los Angeles Times. What did you find?
Well, I looked at the archives of the Los Angeles Times, and of course on the West Coast, the primary role of newspapers, whose proprietors were often major land developers or owners, like the Otis Chandler dynasty of the Times, was to burnish paradise, to sell land. You can find, for instance, that the LA Times very frequently either downplayed or simply didn't report disasters. The cure is to get some classical investigative reportage at the strategic links where campaign contributions turn in the right to undertake irresponsible development. The most important agency in Southern California in terms of land use are the regional planning departments and regional planning commissions of the different county governments. And I once counted how often the LA Times covered the LA County Regional Planning Commission. And except for one year when there was a monumental scandal involved, the Times covered this agency less than once a year.
Instead, you found one narrative the local media have had a long and deep attachment to, and that's the story of the arsonist?
Well, yes, certainly there, you know, are arsonists, and anybody who sets a fire with the deliberate goal of killing people and destroying their homes should be in Supermax in Pelican Bay. But this is one of the great hoary myths of the American West. During the First World War, of course, you know, there were German arsonists everywhere. During the Second World War, the Japanese. And my fear today, because there's an FBI arson investigation going on, is we're going to find some convenient link to the war on terrorism or to the immigration issue. What fire scientists will tell you is that the biggest single cause of big fires like this is probably power lines blowing down as they always do during big Santa Ana winds. And even if all the arsonists could be identified genetically and locked up, it probably wouldn't make a bit of difference to the fire pattern.
Los Angeles is arguably the entertainment capital of the country, and you've noted that there are many depictions of some of the very real natural disasters of L.A. popping up in cultural portrayals of the city, in films and so on.
Fictional or celluloid depictions of the destruction of Los Angeles, which now count, I mean, found more than 100 novels or films, is turned from tragedy to farce. And certainly we can identify with, you know, the comedy of movies like Wilshire Boulevard or Towering Inferno, but has begun to metamorphosize in the last couple of decades into something more sinister and disturbing, which is if you see one of these movies, the Martians invade and they destroy Fifth Avenue, and it's very frightening and horrible. but then they incinerate some screaming hippies or gay men on top of a skyscraper in West Hollywood, and suddenly it's okay.
So you're comparing, say, the destruction of people in Washington and in New York, say, in the film Independence Day, with the jokey incineration of counterculture types in L.A. in the same film.
Sure. I mean, and on one level, that's just pardonable East Coast humor at the expense of arrogant Hollywood types who everybody in America likes to see destroyed by space villains or giant insects. But there's a much darker literature out there of novels that blend into the kind of Christian apocalyptic genre, where it's the punishment of L.A. for its sins. L.A. is depicted in the way that the Lower East Side of New York or Chicago were depicted at the turn of the century, you know, full of immigrants, full of violent lower classes.
What do you think the impact is of all of these fictional depictions of the destruction of L.A. on people who don't live where you live?
It is, of course, grist to Hollywood's mill, but it also tends to naturalize totally false images of the city, either the expectation that, you know, the Los Angeles area should always be bright sunshine and Gidget at the seashore, or the idea that this is a desert supported entirely by stolen water, too dangerous for anybody to live in, so that when disasters do happen, then the blame can be easily shifted to, you know, Mother Nature or to global warming. And it doesn't force us to look at the political and land use decisions over time that increased these hazards and magnified our vulnerability to the ordinary natural forces in our landscape.
And so if we want to translate this into pop culture terms, we should be watching Independence Day less and Chinatown more.
Absolutely.
Mike, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Mike Davis is the author of Ecology of Fear. On the internet, the saying goes, no one knows you're a dog or a giant internet service provider masquerading as an ordinary user. And apparently, that's what the ISP Comcast is doing. When file sharers use services like BitTorrent to try and load a file from a Comcast user, an MP3, say, or a movie, Comcast sends coded messages to both computers telling them to stop the transfer. It's like a telephone operator breaking into a conversation telling each person in the voice of the other, sorry, I have to hang up. Goodbye. So writes Associated Press reporter Peter Svensson, who conducted a test to confirm Comcast's use of the tactic, and it illustrates the power of ISPs to control the activity of their users. In fact, they always had the power, but they're rarely caught actually using it. It goes to the core of the argument over network neutrality. Advocacy groups, not to mention giant web-based companies like Google, eBay, and Amazon, want legislation to ensure that broadband providers treat all data equally. Otherwise, they say, ISPs could make websites pay huge sums to ensure their pages load quickly, thus giving rich companies an advantage over small and sometimes more innovative startups. The AP's Peter Svensson exposed Comcast's undercover interference when he used a file-sharing service to try and download an electronic version of the Bible.
When I here in New York on a non-Comcast connection try to download a copy of the Bible from Comcast subscribers in other areas of the country, that transfer was blocked. And we traced the interference to messages apparently inserted by Comcast. And these messages had forged return addresses, the addresses of the two computers at either end of the connection.
A lot of people are using these peer-to-peer networks to illegally download copywritten material, but legal content is also being distributed by these services.
That's right. We used a non-copyrighted file, obviously. It was also actually quite a small file, and that transfer was, in fact, blocked, or as Comcast would say, it was delayed.
Now, let's talk about that distinction, because it's an important one. A delay is not a block. What do we have here?
This is really gets into semantics here. Comcast is saying eventually they will let those connections through. And I saw that in one case where we kept trying to retrieve the Bible. And after 10 minutes, it did in fact connect and transfer. 10 minutes is a very long time in internet terms. And I think Comcast is hoping that the person who's trying to download from a Comcast subscriber is going to conclude that, okay, I'm not getting it from there. I'm going to download it from some other ISP. So they're sort of shifting the traffic away from themselves.
So how did Comcast justify its actions?
They're saying that they need to manage the network to keep it running smoothly for all its users. The reason they're deciding to stifle file sharing traffic first is that it's traffic that's continuous. People will leave their applications going for days and maybe even weeks on end, continuously sending upstream traffic, and that's a big headache. And the ISPs say a relatively small number of their subscribers are heavy users of this file sharing traffic.
So they're road hogs.
Yes, road hogs or bandwidth hogs.
But this action of Comcast to herd the hogs over to one side of the road, it doesn't just affect Comcast users, right?
No, in fact, Comcast users may be the ones who notice it the least. Comcast is not blocking downloads of, for instance, files on BitTorrent. If they were doing that, it would be immediately noticeable to their subscribers and they'd be inundated with calls. Instead, they're blocking some uploads. Really, the people who are the most affected here are people on other ISPs who are trying to download from Comcast subscribers. And if it so happens that a certain file you want is only on the computers of Comcast subscribers, you may be unable to get that file. And certainly, if more ISPs started doing the same thing Comcast is doing, we could pretty much say goodbye to file sharing. It's difficult to see how file sharing could survive.
But wouldn't it also be difficult to see how broadband service would survive if the ability to send and receive these large files was so circumscribed?
Yeah, I think we're moving away from the early phase of the internet, which was very much about email and web surfing. And unfortunately, some ISPs are poorly set up to make this transition from an internet that's less about us pulling down content from the big content providers and more about being creative and being sharers.
Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Associated Press reporter Peter Svensson. Halloween marks the deadline for a strike by the Writers Guild of America, and it seems increasingly likely that some 12,000 TV and film writers will walk off the job on Thursday. The Guild says writers deserve compensation when their work is reconfigured for the web, as, say, streaming shorts or webisode extras. But the companies they're battling say there's no model yet for determining residuals on that stuff. Rebecca Winters Keegan, Hollywood correspondent for Time magazine, says the last strike, almost 20 years ago, caused a fair amount of damage.
1988 was the last time there was a strike. It lasted 22 weeks. It cost the industry about $500 million. And almost immediately, you could see the evidence of the strike on your TV screen. If you remember the proliferation of primetime news magazines, it was already underway before that point, but it really was helped by the writers' strike. You saw shows like Primetime Live on multiple nights a week, Dateline.
Hard Copy was created during the strike, right?
It was, yeah. Hard Copy was created during the strike. Another place where people quickly saw a difference was in the late night monologues. Both Jay Leno and David Letterman at a certain point curtailed their monologues because it was just too hard to write an original, pithy material every night with The Daily Show. And Letterman actually attempted to write his top 10 list without his impressive staff of writers, and he came up with only a top 2 list.
But this time, the studios have contingency plans, so they're not letting us know what they are.
Because the executives all are concerned about giving away their strategy to the other networks. But they have all been really stockpiling episodes. They've been working at a feverish pace since the summer.
Another part of their secret contingency plan, I understand, is the use of reruns, like Heroes and Grey's Anatomy will go into reruns.
Right. Well, it's interesting because do people remember reruns? Reruns used to be on in the summer before Dancing with the Stars and other reality shows rushed in to fill the gap. But there are certain shows like Lost, for instance, which has this kind of Byzantine plot, which might actually benefit from some reruns and people getting a chance to figure out what's going on. Another plan that certain people have been talking about that the networks might use is picking up some British shows. For instance, there's been talk that NBC will pick up the British version of The Office with Ricky Gervais to replace the American version of The Office with Steve Carell.
And although the Steve Carell show is great, so is the Ricky Gervais British original version of the show, so that could prove to be of some benefit to the American audience. Are there other possible programming benefits that might accrue from this strike?
Well, one thing that's interesting is that news shows, which are struggling and fighting to stay on the air, might get a longer chance to develop. You know, the networks have gotten so quick to yank shows off the air. There are certain shows like CBS's Kane, Fox's Kayville, ABC's Big Shots, which would have a longer time to build an audience. Patience can give a show a chance. Patience launched Seinfeld.
Let's talk about the impact on the big screen now. Obviously, there's a way longer lead time when it comes to producing movies. How long would it take before we start seeing an impact on big screen releases?
People who go to the box office wouldn't see the evidence of the work people are doing now on those scripts until probably 2009.
A lot of people probably don't realize that the writer's job isn't necessarily ended when filming begins.
Writers are involved from the very beginning of the process to the very end. Sometimes they are rewriting on set. Sometimes a movie has wrapped and it's not testing well with audiences and a rewrite and reshoot is required. That's happened on the first two Bourne movies, for instance. So writers stay involved through the whole process. It's not just a question of turning in the script and going home.
Have you thought about what the impact of a long dry spell might be on the audience, especially when other kinds of entertainment are chipping away at TV viewership? Viewers could abandon TV the way that sports fans abandoned baseball after that famously protracted strike. The stakes could be the whole TV audience.
The stakes could be the whole TV audience. Because the stakes are that high, I think both sides will not want to see a strike last very long. Nobody in the entertainment industry wants people to start turning away from the entertainment industry.
Rebecca, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rebecca Winters Keegan is Hollywood correspondent for Time Magazine. Throughout TV's history, we've seen shows that revolve around the paranormal, but this season seems a trifle abnormal. There's Moonlight, about a vampire private eye, and True Blood, another vampire show from Six Feet Under creator Alan Ball. There's New Amsterdam, about an immortal cop, and Supernatural, where young detectives hunt down evil spirits. There's even a reality show, kind of, called Phenomenon. It debuted this week on NBC, where people compete to prove who has the most psychic powers.
We've searched the world to bring you 10 astonishing individuals who will claim to be able to see into the future and actually speak to those who are no longer with us tonight.
From whence this freaky trend? Partly it's the lack of imagination in network executive suites, says New York Times TV critic Alessandra Stanley, but partly it's a sign of our times, just as the popularity of the occult was given a boost during the Civil War.
It is true that there was a rise in interest in spiritualism and particularly in communication between the dead and the living after the Civil War, because there were so many people who were bereaved and who were seeking some kind of solace and would turn to, you know, Ouija boards and seances and all those things. But there were all kinds of reasons. I mean, every time that there is a moment of progress in science, there's a backlash against it. People sort of naturally grope towards some theory that allows for both. When photography was new, there were certain ways of taking portraits of people. With a certain light or a certain way of printing it, you would have an aura. And there was a whole school of photography that was supposed to be, you know, sort of occult photography that captured not the face of the person, but their inner soul. It happens in cycles all the time.
But the nature of the paranormal that we saw in television's early days was quite different. For one thing, nobody thought it was real. You had Rod Serling's Twilight Zone that ran from 1959 to 64, and then a bunch of comedies soon after that, Bewitched, I Dream of Jeannie, My Favorite Martian.
It's really hard to know why Was it just that executives have no imagination, so if it worked on one network, then everybody scrambled to do copycat versions of the same idea? Or was it that there was a playfulness in the comedy that allowed for all kinds of metaphors for repression of the times? You know, I've heard it said that, you know, I Dream of Jeannie and all these things are about homosexuality, that you have this eccentricity, you have this secret side that you have to keep to yourself. Only instead of saying, you know, it's my homosexuality, it's my imaginary friend from inside a bottle or something like that.
And you note in your piece that in Bewitched, the witch, Samantha, spent all her time trying to appear normal and make things seem normal for her husband.
Vacuum cleaner, I have a problem. I can spend 4 hours pushing you around and cleaning the attic, in which case I won't have any time to spend with Darren. Or, well, you know, get it all done in a flash and relax for the rest of the afternoon with my husband.
Well, that would certainly support the notion that this effort at conformity was such a strain that this poor woman who could do anything in the world with her magical powers spent it all trying to get dinner on time.
After 9/11, we saw a spike in religious-themed programming, paranormal in the sense that, you know, the Bible is.
What was interesting was that in one season, you had three different versions of the same idea, which was a kind of Joan of Arc fantasy. One was called Joan of Arcadia, and that was a police detective's daughter.
Who are you?
I'm God.
You're what?
God.
Another one was True Calling, and then there was a third one called Wonderfalls, which was just a sort of, you know, ordinary slacker like you or me, Brooke, who ends up working in a gift shop, and then all the little figurines start talking to her, and they turn out to be the voice of God. But now we have something a little bit different. Television has been long preoccupied with the sort of hospital shows or cop shows for the last 30 years. We like to solve murders, but we're kind of tired of forensic science, so that it's almost as if you took CSI Imaginary, you know, tried to basically do the same show. Who killed this person and why? But instead of looking for physical evidence, the dead person himself explains who killed him, which really does solve a lot.
Basically, they're pouring old wine into a somewhat new bottle.
Right. The reason it fits into this new bottle is because this new bottle suddenly has more resonance than it used to. We're now at a period where we're talking a lot about horrible calamities that are man-made, be it global warming or terrorism or war or weapons of mass destruction. These are all things that basically we can only blame ourselves. So it's not that surprising that we would suddenly look for shows or entertainment or distraction for things in which there is a supernatural being or explanation for things, so that you can sort of find a supernatural scapegoat. People who are doing with the plague blame themselves, but it was less concrete, you know, because they sort of thought, well, we're being punished for untold sins. But there's a similar kind of yearning for dramatic explanations, i.e. ones that are, you know, paranormal.
Alessandra, it was a pleasure.
Thank you, Brooke.
Alessandra Stanley is a TV critic for The New York Times. Meanwhile, all is not peaceful in the suburbs of Baltimore. Banner of Laconia has declared war against Keldar of Mordom, who rules the land with iron determination.
A test of our bravery!
The sound you hear is of live-action role-players, or LARPers, battling in the parks and campgrounds of Maryland for control over the fictional realm of Darkon, the subject of a documentary premiering next month on the Independent Film Channel. Banner is really Skip Lipman, a stay-at-home dad, and Keldar is Kenyon Wells, a business manager, both main characters in a non-fictional movie that asks, what is it we really get from our fictional entertainment? For many players of Darkon, the game offers something that life does not.
In the heat of battle, home to the razor's edge by the test of the gods!
You come to this game and you're able to wheel and deal with people, manipulate things, make things work. Something I wish I could do in real life.
I don't really have control in this house, especially as long as Mom's home. Because this is her house, she's in control. I go to work, my boss is in control. I go to Darkon, I'm in control.
when I walk out here, I'm a different person. I could act like I'm not Danny. I like Danny, but sometimes Danny doesn't have the balls to do what Danny needs to.
The last voice you heard was Daniel MacArthur, a.k.a. Trivious Gorgo, a self-described nerd who goes to school and works at Starbucks. I asked the co-director of Darkon, Andrew Neal, why Danny and so many other players express so much dissatisfaction with the real world.
I think that the dissatisfaction that they voice about the world around them is something that I think a lot of people could associate with. We're trapped behind desks and in offices and with email, and the world is becoming increasingly virtual, and you want to interact with the world physically, face to face. And that's what Darkon offers. And I think that that's actually one of the things that people often misread in the movie. This game is their ticket to reality, in my opinion. It's a fantasy, yes, and it's escapism, yes, but they do it to feel real.
I've actually got a relationship trying to go on in character with a certain nomad, and I've been following and helping this person more than anybody else, and it's cost me several things, like my life on several occasions, but it's beautiful.
Now, Danny tells us that, as Trivious, he has spoken to girls in the game. We don't know whether he's been able to transfer that newly acquired skill to real life, but there are others who claim very strongly that they have, specifically Kenyon Wells, a.k.a. Keldar. He's talked about how the game changed him.
Kenyon is maybe, Keldar in the game, Kenyon out of the game, is maybe one of the best examples of someone that really used the game as an apparatus for personal and social development. Through the game, he developed his own sense of self.
Did it concern you at all that Darkon was capable of turning what his mother said was a very mild-mannered kid named Kenyon Wells into kind of an SOB? Too strong?
You know, who he is not, as a documentary filmmaker, for me to judge, but he used the game to get self-confidence and to achieve what he wanted to achieve.
Long before, in my professional career, I was ready for a management position, I was managing a large group of people in Darkon. Long before I was ready to negotiate a multi-million dollar business contract, I was negotiating a treaty between our country and other countries in Darkon. And while one is for fun and the other is for money, in reality, people are people, and it's still the same sort of drivers.
So was the Kenyon that Keldar helped Kenyon become someone that was already there? Who knows?
Keldar was who I wanted to be. Over time, playing at Keldar helped me become the man I wanted to be.
You told us earlier in the week that most directors, given this material, would probably have made the self-described nerdy Starbucks kid, Trivious Gorgo, or Daniel, in real life, the focus of the movie. Why do you think they would have, and why didn't you?
I think it's pretty easy to look at a character like Danny and boil down the activity to kind of like, you know, they're not happy with their real lives, so they play this game, or, you know, they can have an alternate reality where things are better. I don't think that's what Luke and I were interested in getting into. We wanted to bring to life the inner world of the people who played the game and to get the kind of emotional essence of what it felt like to be out there on the field.
There are two ways that this can end. Peaceably through the tribunal or war.
We have fought many wars. We won all of them.
Hail Mortem!
Hail Mortem!
Hail Cutters!
Hail Cutters!
I mean, if you stand back from a battle and just shoot it in a wide shot, it can be really boring. They kind of slap each other a whole bunch of times. Some people fall down, and then that's it. They get up and do it again. What we wanted to do was to try to get inside their mind and create a kind of Hollywood reality that we think that they sometimes live in when they're playing the game.
A Hollywood reality.
Yeah.
Well, that's part of what makes this so interesting, because most entertainment, including video games and movies, is highly mediated, meaning that other people determine the frame, the plot, the environment. The uber creator of Darkon is absent, or at least it seems to be wholly the possession of its participants now. Is that what makes it unmediated? Does that change the experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a shared fantasy. I mean, I think television and online role-playing games and video games, they're kind of the opposite of Darkon because they feed you the fantasy. They remove you from the process of creation and destruction. And that's one of the things that really makes Darkon so warty and idiosyncratic and in that way beautiful. And so while Darkon seems so weird, it's actually very human and makes perfect sense to me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Neil is co-director with Luke Meyer of the documentary Darkon, which premieres November 12th on the Independent Film Channel.
The one thing that I do need,
yes,
and will pay greatly for, is a supernatural death poison.
Okay.
Up next, an avatar anchors the news, and algorithms strip the skin off of the New York Times. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And here's a guy on YouTube.
Oh, all right. I was just watching the Colbert Report tonight, and I found out that Stephen Colbert is running for president in South Carolina. And I got to tell you, I am tickled pink. I hope this guy throws a monkey wrench into the whole thing.
Well, all right. In 20 seconds, that random guy summed up the entire discussion consuming pundits across all media. Plenty are tickled pink, plenty aren't, but all are obsessed with the monkey wrench. Stephen Colbert said yesterday that his campaign for president was no joke, intoned the New York Post, and that could be a problem. No doubt, lesser politicians will try to drag this utterly selfless, kind-hearted candidate through the mud, wrote the Dallas Morning News. Others will seize his arch-conservative, pro-war, pro-global warming agenda as their own, it went on. But accept no substitutes. This guy's the real thing. Here he is on Meet the Press.
I don't know. I think a lot of people are asking whether they say, is this real? You know, and to which I would say to everybody, this is not a dream. OK, you're not going to wake up from this. OK, I'm far realer than Sam Brownback. Let me put it that way.
Some have observed that Brownback jumped out of the race when Colbert jumped in. Unfair to draw a causal relationship there. Colbert presents an equal risk to any candidate that indulges in cliches or cant or moral posturing, meaning all of them. Here's MSNBC's Dan Abrams.
Tonight, a new poll of Democrats shows that Stephen Colbert, the comedian, the late-night TV host, is actually shaking up the race for president. Yes, the fake candidate is creating ripples by beating real ones.
The respected Rasmussen polling service conducted a survey and found that in a three-way matchup with Hillary Clinton and Rudolph Giuliani, Colbert won 13% of the vote. And among young voters, he has more support than any Republican running. Comedy, we know, is a matter of timing, and Colbert has the best there is for the 2008 election. The character he crafted, as pointed and specific as it is, offers something for everyone. He's a blank canvas, a Rorschach test of collective revulsion. For those sick of the GOP's hounding of gays and immigrants, for those tired of the cravenness and hypocrisy of Democrats, for those repulsed by ersatz appeals to the working man, for those dismayed by the toothless campaign finance laws Colbert might be violating, for those weary of the political circus, the media circus, the national security circus, to all of us, he presents a bag of popcorn and a balloon. As he made eminently clear when he sat down with Tim Russert, he really doesn't have to say anything anymore. We're more than happy to fill in the blanks.
I'm doing it, Tim, because I think our country is facing unprecedented challenges in the future. And I think that the junctures that we face are both critical and unforeseen. And the real challenge is how we will respond to these junctures, be they unprecedented or unforeseen, or God help us, critical.
You've thought this through.
That's a generous estimation. Thank you.
So, the people speak on YouTube. They sing on YouTube, too. That's all I have to say about Colbert, except one thing. He's an admitted purveyor of fake news. Now it seems that the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Deputy Administrator Harvey Johnson has also taken a crack at it. On Tuesday, he called a fake press conference and answered questions from fake reporters, actually members of his own staff, related to his agency's response to the California fires. Later, he issued an apology. Now let's move from fake reporters to computer-generated news anchors that report stories with the help of digital editors and producers. A computer scientist at Northwestern University is aiming to create a program that will do just that. And what's more, he says his digital journalists will be uniquely capable of bringing us the news that we really, really want to hear. Chicago Public Radio's Sean Ali explains.
If you went to bed early the evening of August 7th, you closed your eyes on a bit of baseball history. The San Francisco Giants' Barry Bonds hammered a record-breaking career home run.
The overshift is on, and Bassett deals. And Bonds hits one high! Hits it deep! It is out of here! 7:56!
By morning, TV producers, editors, and reporters pick through wire reports and footage to fashion coverage. But at Northwestern University, a computer did the same thing. Here's the computer avatar news anchor, Alex Vance, presenting the story in front of shifting video footage.
For one spectacular moment, Barry Bonds and everybody cheering him could forget about the controversy surrounding his chase and appreciate the phenomenal feat. 756.
Okay, it's not Walter Cronkite, but...
I'm happy to say it. Right now, we got a bear on a bike.
Computer scientist Christian Hammond created Alex.
And what's amazing is not that it rides the bike well, but it rides the bike at all.
Sure, Hammond admits Alex needs a voice coach, and the video is shaky user-generated stuff. But Hammond didn't create just a digital news anchor. He created a software package called News at 7 that produces and edits its newscast, too. With the Barry Bonds story, Hammond picked the topic. From there, News at 7 reworked text from the web and snagged video from YouTube. Hammond needed help to get this far.
We dealt with the problem of what do journalists do the way we deal with any problem, because we're a university, damn it. We went to another department. So we went over to Medill. We have an entire journalism school.
That is, Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. Hammond sent his grad students to Medill lecturer Beth Bennett. She says when it came to the basics, News at 7's avatar Alex was green as a freshman.
Even minor things like gesturing. It's amazing how many students get up on the anchor desk for the first time and they don't gesture.
Now, Alex nods and moves her hands to give occasional emotional punch, and the program follows Bennett's advice to keep sentences short and simple. By all accounts, Bennett's journalism students were aghast.
I wasn't sure how to tell my students, hey guys, I'm bringing in an engineering grad student who's going to create a virtual newscast and potentially take jobs away from you.
But Hammond says they shouldn't panic.
I mean, we might replace them at one task, but that means that they'll get to be doing something better. So the person who sits there and edits the AP wire as it comes in, so if you put on the teleprompter, if we have a system that can do that for them, they can look at what's coming over the AP wire and they can start thinking about it.
In other words, Hammond wants computers to sweat the small stuff, while reporters and producers find better content for hosts, be they human or avatar. And, says Hammond, News at 7 could fix another problem, one that's dogged broadcast news from the outset, having to snag the biggest audience possible.
Even in niche areas, it's like entertainment news. It has to be for everyone who cares about entertainment. And that is, it's broad. It's broadcast. It's for everybody.
Even nimble broadcasters can only tailor their news so much, even when they solicit audience suggestions.
Then they have to translate that into one person writes them a letter, and then they have to say, okay, everybody, we have to do the everybody version of this. We can do the you version of this.
So the latest version of his software tailors news, sports, and weather to an individual's interests and location. And the final frontier is the hyper-personal, computer-generated news from online social networks.
If you tell the system, here are my friends on MySpace, and the system can track them. And when their pages change, it can talk to you about that. And so we really like the notion of, you know, today is going to be sunny and warm. The Cubs have once again choked. And by the way, your friend Mary has just recommended a new band. Here's a clip from it.
Medill professors familiar with the software say it might have a place on news websites. But here's one worry. Will hyper-customization mean the computer mixes professionally produced news and blogs and gossip from social networks? Journalism professor Beth Bennett wonders about credibility.
You know, if someone gives a journalist information that's incorrect or inaccurate, we have to make the call not to even put it out there for the listener or the viewer to make a decision about. And those decisions, I think, are best left to journalists.
Several Medill professors want to know how News at 7 settles on what to air. After all, who's making the moral decisions about what to report?
The decisions about what it says will actually come from three sources. People saying, here's what I want to hear. And us, the sort of the system builders, making decisions as best we can about where we're going to get the news from and how we're going to manage it. And then there's something that's called an emergent behavior. And that is the system itself will probably make decisions that we don't expect.
Emergent behavior we don't expect? Right now, a major check on a journalistic mistake is that someone in a vast audience will catch it. For the foreseeable future, Alex and her avatar colleagues are academic experiments. But if Hammond software ever does deliver the you version of the news, you might be the only media watchdog in the room. For On the Media, I'm Sean Ali.
Technology has been part of the news business since movable type, some might argue since the invention of the quill. But of course, the technology keeps changing. In our lifetimes, we've heard it change from this to this. The newsroom of the spanking new headquarters of the New York Times.
People like to come here. They do.
David Carr covers media for the Times.
They really like to come here, but if you guys look around much, you go, well, this looks like a very nicely appointed insurance company. It's really quiet. It's kind of churchy. And like, if you ever really lose it and start screaming your head off, which you're not really a newsman, if you don't, you're really going to stick out.
The process of making the newspaper used to be filled with sound.
Artist Ben Rubin.
There was the clatter of typewriters in the newsroom itself. There were the sounds of all the machinery from the teletype machines that would clank away with the incoming news from the wire services to the linotype machines that were slamming away, manipulating hot lead to make these printing plates, and then the printing presses themselves, which at a certain time of the night would kick in and start to rumble and shake the building, and you could smell it, you could hear it, you could see it.
You can no longer smell it. But you can hear it and see it, in a way, in the lobby. In the form of a piece of art, an installation called Movable Type, what you hear are synthesized sounds of ancient typewriters, teletype machines, rotary phones. Sometimes you hear the whoosh of sonar or the fracas of buzzers. And what you see are words, thousands of them, cascading across more than 500 small gray screens hanging in columns along the long walls of the central lobby. It's a massive grid, a checkerboard of portholes into the minds of 1,000 scribes. The screens work together, offering fragments of the day's paper, the month's papers, or 150 years of papers. The words come at you in patterns. Call them scenes. Sometimes the scenes are words pulled from letters to the editor, sometimes from the obits or wedding announcements, the crossword puzzle, 12 scenes in all. Sometimes the screens are filled with quotes from recent stories. Since you can't see them, we'll read them for you.
I don't want to belong to any club that will accept me as a member.
You can be comfortable, yet dressy.
I have no idea why we got saved and others didn't.
You have to take punishment like a dancer.
I am not a modern art aficionado.
You have to sacrifice so much to the horse.
Another scene offers the day's stories reduced to their numbers.
One idea.
5 gallon buckets worth of sulfate particles in the stratosphere.
50 years.
1% of that money.
Or questions culled from the day's news.
Can anyone really agree on the definition of shifty eyes?
How dare they kill our squirrels?
How could we be a good match if he didn't approve of my hijab?
Didn't the doorman object?
Did it have a particular smell? Like teen spirit?
What do you like about Guantanamo?
Who's a good dog?
David Carr.
I think what those guys have done downstairs brings a little of the magic and a little of the mystique. And there's part of writing that's mysterious. Who knows where it comes from? And who knows how these words fly in. And I think that installation with its random aphoristic sayings kind of replicates the writing process.
The guys downstairs are New York-based artist Ben Rubin and UCLA statistics professor Mark Hansen. And they've worked for about 4 years to produce Movable Type. The team, which had produced art based on data before, sat down early in the process with the designer of the Times' new headquarters, architect Renzo Piano, Ben Rubin.
Within about 30 seconds of sitting down with him, he said to me, "This piece needs to last for at least 200 years." That was really one of the very first things he said. And it's quite a challenge.
Mark Hansen has spent long hours in the lobby of the Times programming natural language processing algorithms, whatever they are, to craft the scenes. Scenes that will continue to play out long after Hansen and Rubin appear in the obits. I'm sure they won't mind I said that. It's quite an honor. They had to work in the lobby because that is where the installation will live.
Some of the pacing, the rate at which things move down the hall, we've kind of tuned based on how people walk.
Mark Hansen.
During the letters to the editor scene, the dun-dun-dun. I can't tell you how many times I've had groups of people with heavy shoes kind of fall into that same walking pattern because it's got that kind of rhythm. And so when you're sitting down there, you'll stop and you'll, as you're programming it, you'll do something and you'll see what stops them.
Piano told the artist that the work should function as a kind of organism with rhythms that mimic those of the Times itself, ebbing and flowing by day.
And at night, it will dream. And the dreams will be bits of text, whole articles sometimes, pulled from the 150-year archives of the Times, sometimes totally at random, sometimes connected to something that might have appeared in that day's paper. That will sort of be, as we all do when we dream, the piece will be kind of sifting through its recent and distant memories and sometimes making sense and sometimes not so much sense.
But Movable Type does more than dream the dream of the Times. It depicts in ways both graceful and jarring, meaningful and nonsensical, the ocean of bits and bytes we all swim in. The tabloid headline, the radio dispatch, the billboard, the talking head, the electronic sign, the snatch of conversation overheard.
You end up with a running narrative.
David Carr.
In that sense, what those guys did downstairs, which is offering bits which are stored and recalled in ones and zeros by all of us later and assembled into some kind of comprehensible picture of the world that we live in. I think it's a really great metaphor.
And now a great newspaper has a great organism breathing and belching and occasionally screeching in its lobby. And it will change as the Times does, as we all do. We can walk by without looking at it, but it will always be looking at us.
I can't sleep, and it's getting under my skin.
You won't live to see 40, I promise you.
I am disgraced. I am ashamed. I let the Navy down.
You can't keep doing this job forever in this day and age.
I am absolutely sure he never knew what hit him.
You can hear a dime drop. Absolute silence.
I don't curse. I don't yell.
You should not even ask.
I don't know what the pattern is, if there is one.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Buolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Jessica McGaldi and Ian Whitehead. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.